I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. Great joy today to welcome Norma Ramirez to our Conversing conversation. Norma is a PhD student in the School of Psychology at Fuller Seminary, and her story is one that we're going to explore today for a number of reasons, but probably the most specific reason has to do with the fact that she is a DACA student. We will talk about what that means. And in her case, it's also had this week a particular importance because she's been one of the specifically named plaintiffs in the case that was taken up and brought to the Supreme Court. And we're going to be exploring DACA in general, her experience in DACA, and then this particular experience that's led up to the Supreme Court this week and where we go now, which is an open question as we wait a Supreme Court response. So I'm really, really, really grateful that she's willing to have this conversation. And we also welcome a friend and a mentor and a pastor who is with her, whose name is Sonia Lugenbull, who is a person that accompanied Norma and six other people who all went as kind of a delegation around Fuller and beyond to the Supreme Court this week. And we're also very glad to be able to welcome Dr. Lisette Rojas Flores, who is a professor of psychology here at Fuller and has been a particularly close partner and professor mentor to Norma in this process and was a part of the delegation that went from here to the Supreme Court as well. So we're very glad to welcome all three of you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So Norma, let's just start first of all by having you tell a bit of your story as an immigrant coming to the U.S. Eventually, I want to come to talk about DACA and the meaning of DACA, but just give us a larger framework.
I came to the U.S. when I was 5 years old. And I lived in Las Vegas for most of my life until I applied to grad school here at Fuller. In between that time, as I reflect on it, I think that there were certain experiences that I had that were very particular, I think, to being undocumented. A lot of it had to do with access to resources. And I think also just the effect that it had on my family. For example, because of just the way systems work, you know, in order to just provide for us, like my parents would work all the time. And for my dad specifically, I think he had difficulty adjusting to a new country. And I think he missed his family. So he also had difficulty just spending time with us. And so then my mom having to be the person to provide in the absence of him. And I think what that ended up happening is that in that way, emotionally, I don't think I lived with my parents. I understood their love as a way of shelter, of support, of providing. But the emotional pieces of having that, you know, holding space or talking to them didn't happen. And for me, it was more that I saw the weight of it. I think I saw how much they were working, how tired they were, and I didn't want to burden them anymore than they needed to be. And so then I just kind of took that upon myself. And for whatever reason, you know, genetics or whatever, I was good at school, I was smart. And so I figured out my way to the best of my ability without having them sort of as involved. You know, there was a point where they couldn't help me anymore when I was in college. That system of how to apply to college, where to go to, financial aid, all those things, that wasn't something that they could help me with. And so just from that moment on, it was me figuring that out in terms of school. And really the first time that I felt or that I really started to understand what it meant to be undocumented was when it was time to apply for a job, to apply to colleges for a driver's license, that's really when that impact hit, because before being in school, it was kind of like a protective environment because we didn't need any of that. So once that happened, it was pretty devastating because, you know, I really didn't think I was that different from anyone else. I always got the same questions asked about what do you want to be when you grow up? Mm-hmm. And I've always sort of wanted to be the best that I could be. And at that point, I was being told no, and that there was nothing I could do about it. And so...
So it's like suddenly running into a brick wall that you hadn't really expected.
Yeah. I mean, talking about walls is pretty significant in our time. And yeah, and there was... It felt really unfair. It felt very... I mean, powerless, you know, because I had done everything right. I was even so scared of just, at least with us, breaking any kind of law, because I didn't want to be seen as this narrative that we have about immigrants. And so all of that to then just still be told no was just devastating. And this was around high school, and it took me some time, but eventually I decided to start, you know, asking around, like, what I could do. And I had people tell me that I couldn't go to a private school. I forget why, but that I could go to public school, but then I would not be able to receive financial aid. So it was a weird way of just kind of saying, like, you know, you're probably not going to make it. Like, don't get your hopes up, you know, because of that limitation. And so even then, I felt like I settled and I went to a community college in Las Vegas. And then it was around that time, it was like 2011. And you have to keep in mind that right now, at that time in 2011, people were not talking about immigration and their status and stuff like that. It was still very unknown and very...
privately held.
Yes. Yeah, right. And so I graduated with my associate's in psychology. Then I transferred to UNLV for my bachelor's. And as soon as I transferred, you know, tuition tripled. And I finished my first year, and it was already looking like I was going to have to make certain choices, either if I was going to continue going to school or if I was going to drop out or if I was going to take maybe one class, you know, those kinds of things. And again, timing for whatever reason, I finished that year, so now it's 2012, and then President Obama makes that announcement. And I was also involved in volunteering within our community. And so through just different connections, I ended up being in contact with this nonprofit who was doing this work, and we got trained to do the application ourselves. And so it was a mixture of we are the ones who need help, but now we're trained and we're helping others and somehow finding time to make our own application.
Wow, right. Just before we go farther with the DACA description, I want to hear a little bit more about your family. When you first came, it was from Mexico. That was where your family lived. And it was you. And do you have other siblings?
I have an older sister and a younger brother.
Uh-huh. And they accompanied you?
No, my younger brother was born here when I was 8.
Got it. But your sister did come at the same time. So when you were describing, for example, the sense of isolation from your family in a certain way because of what you were describing about feeling their pressure, did you find with your sister or with other children at school or other places a kind of base of support and similarity of circumstances or not exactly? I couldn't quite tell how you were describing that.
Honestly, within our family, I think that was the impact that this had, is that we never really knew how to spend time together. One of the things that was really shocking to me when I came to Fuller was the idea of tradition and the idea of the liturgy within that, because we didn't have that. And so I think that's sort of the impact that I imagine, you know, my family probably in Mexico, they had something, but being taken away from that and not having the resources to create something had that impact. And in terms of with other students, I didn't think I was any different at that time. I thought we were all the same.
Right.
So I wasn't aware. This is just stuff that's coming up as I look back.
Right. It's amazing. So when DACA then suddenly arrives, do you remember like literally a moment where you were and what you thought when you first heard about this and how it began to wash over you?
Well, I like to sleep. So it was like, I don't know, some like 11 or something at the time. And my pastor at the time, he sent me a text and he said, hey, there's this program that's coming up and you should apply for it. So I looked at it. And at that point, I mean, I didn't know exactly what it meant. I didn't know what an executive order was. And so the fact that it came from my pastor, who I trusted, it at least, I think, helped me engage with this policy more than if I had heard it somewhere else. And then from there, like I mentioned, we found this nonprofit organization that was doing this work. And we really didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know the process, how strict it was going to be, you know. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, we just tried to show as much documentation as possible from whatever we had from, you know, the moment we were here up until then, mm-hmm. which involved even just like transcripts, report cards, pieces of like awards, mm-hmm. if you had any, or mm-hmm. just anything that would show. And I don't think I brought as much stuff as other people. There was this one person that I remember, they brought like suitcases of all their documents.
Oh my gosh.
And it sounds, you know, kind of funny now, but that's like how important this was for
right.
us.
Right, absolutely.
To show like, look, you know, we qualify, we, you know.
Right. We have an identity, we have a meaning, we have a place.
I don't think that came about just yet.
Right.
But it was the pressure of these requirements mm-hmm. that we were trying to meet.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we finally, like, I have a picture of like when I finally sent in my application, and I don't know if I still look that tired, but I was exhausted from all the work that we were doing in terms of filling out our, you know, other applications and my own. But it was also just this feeling of, I finally can have a future, mm-hmm. you know, and it was very emotional.
Wow. You were how old at that moment when that was happening?
2012, so 22.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let's step back. Just, I should have asked you to explain this for everyone listening earlier, but Sonia, can you give us a definition of DACA? I want to be sure that all of our listeners really understand what it is.
Yes. So I think that they began writing it. It was a bipartisan initiative to write into place a deferred action for childhood arrivals for undocumented immigrants, and with a age range of the, when it was implemented. And I'm unclear on that exact age range. Do you know the answer to that?
I think she's wanting Lisette to answer it.
So DACA was granted for those that came as children to the United States up to the age of
34.
The expectation was that those that came as young children will engage in high school and studies here in the States and can demonstrate that they are good contributors to a society in a sense. So they had to demonstrate not only completion of studies in the United States, but also that they didn't have any legal background.
When they could apply for the work permit and the driver's license under the whole, after the application, if the application was approved,
right.
then you could move forward and apply for the work permit and the driver's license?
So the DACA, basically, the protection is the protection against deportation. The fact that they didn't have legal status, DACA would protect them from deportation within a two-year time frame. So it's not a pass-through citizenship whatsoever. It's a temporary band-aid protection against deportation for 2 years. It's a protection that has to be renewed every 2 years, and you have to apply, you have to submit your, again, demonstration that you're in good standing with the law, that you have your fingerprints, that you pay, and you have to meet certain requirements. This is not granted to anybody and just anybody. And that's how, with that protection, that means then you can work And they then, therefore, are able to acquire a driver's license, mm-hmm. which folks that do not have, that are undocumented, are not able to in the majority of the states. That window of protection of being able to work, being able to drive, and in states like California, which is a very unique state, to have access to some financial aid, open up the doors to many of these young folks to pursue higher education, to work and not hide, it opens up a whole host of opportunities. But again, I think I want to emphasize it's a temporary protection, not a path to citizenship in any shape or form.
And you have to keep renewing.
And you have to keep renewing it every 2 years. Yeah. Now, the history is that since DACA was implemented in 2012, it has been a very ambiguous path in many ways for many of these folks because of the threats to terminate DACA. And in fact, in last year, now I'm getting all the facts, when the administration rescinded DACA 2 years ago, what that meant is that we cannot add any new folks, any other young folks that actually meet the criteria to have DACA, they cannot be part of these protections.
Right.
It technically blocks. And now we have folks that are in the program can continue to renew it until this issue is resolved.
Right.
But we cannot add anymore. And in that process, we also lost many folks that were under DACA, but were afraid to continue to renew their DACA status because of all the changes, because of the uncertainty that perhaps the government was going to use their information and, in fact, will not be protection in the end.
Right.
A very high
cost. It could lead to deportation.
It could lead to deportation.
Yeah.
So that's a big issue.
Right. And there's about over 800,000 people that are covered by DACA, approximately. Is that?
Eligible.
Exactly. At this moment, we have about 700. I mean, it's an estimate, obviously.
And so as we come toward the establishment of DACA, then the experience of DACA for you, Norma, then opens up some new doors and a greater sense of freedom and a possibility of the future, which is what you were saying. But as Lisette was just saying, there's also this amazing sense of instability in that, both because you have to renew it and also because there's been such legal and political hardball that's been played around how DACA status should be held. So before we come to the case itself, just say a little bit more about what the doors are that got opened for you. What wasn't open to you before and what then became open to you because of DACA? We've talked about the driver's license, ability to work, a sense of freedom because of not having to worry as much about if you violated the law in any kind of way or whatever that might be.
Yeah. And so even with that, it was things like just traveling, like going to, you know, Arizona. And that's like one of the big things that, at least in our communities, it was a big no-no. Like, don't do that. Don't go to the border. But one thing that actually our friends, that me and our friends did is that we went all the way down to San Diego just to see the Mexican flag.
Right.
And we did run across border agents, but it was different because now we didn't have to be afraid. We could say we were there and they didn't ask us for anything, you know, but had we not had that status, the anxiety, the fear, whatever, we could have done something stupid that we wouldn't have, you know, that could have developed in something else.
Right.
And so, yeah, there was that sense of that, which I think is more human, I think, in terms of traveling, wanting to explore, driving.
Sure.
And whenever I did road trips with friends, they were very keen and aware that I was never going to drive before. But even then, after, it's like being able to drive on these road trips, contribute and be part of, you know, our experience together makes a difference.
Sure.
And the other piece, I think, which is a little bit more, I think, psychological, is that it validated me as a person. I now had, you know, this government ID to say who I was, which I didn't have before. One of the first things I did was go get a library card because you need a government-issued ID to get a library card. And that's not something that I think people realize the impact of, like, even in these smaller places, mm-hmm. how it's all connected. Mm-hmm. You know, the list just goes on in ways of mm-hmm. how this impacted our lives. And it also gave me courage. I mean, it gave me courage. Hold on, let me go back. Because of DACA specifically, I was able to complete my bachelor's in psychology. So like I was mentioning, that time came where I tuition tripled and all of that. And so once I did receive DACA, I worked as much as I could and I saved everything I had and paid off tuition. Like, that's how that was possible.
Right.
And from there, knowing where I was applying to, knowing that, you know, I wasn't in California, and also just the fact that it was a new program. Right now, there's more help and more financial support. Mm-hmm. But before, there wasn't. And so it at least gave me the courage to ask for help, to, mm-hmm. you know, go and explore what my options could be. And I don't know how much you want me to talk about Fuller.
I want to come to that in just a second. But what I'm interested in first is, I just want to acknowledge for people that are listening to this, I think for any of us who have never experienced the life of being undocumented, it's really hard to grasp the sense of acute vulnerability that just comes from a sense that at any given moment something could happen that would cause someone, especially with legal authority, to somehow intersect with your life in such a way that everything could change in a moment, which is what you were describing earlier. So I just want to pause in part to just say to people who are listening how I think important it is for us to be able to try to step into some kind of imagination about what that experience is like and how powerful it is as a DACA recipient to simply receive, albeit a temporary, still vulnerable, flexible, but at least a real form of protection, which simply didn't exist without that. And I think as you go forward with your story, I just am always struck by the way that DACA has allowed people to tell the story of being undocumented in a way that was harder to tell before, at least among people that are DACA recipients. So,
Mark, can I just say something?
Yeah, please.
Because I think it's important. Somebody the other day said, oh, I get it. I was born poor. And I get what it is to be poor and what it means yes. to be undocumented. And I right. said, I think you get a very good idea what it is. But what we know now from research is that the vulnerability and the risk and the detrimental effects of being undocumented is even above and beyond poverty.
Yes, yes.
So if you're poor, you still have access to legal services, yes. protections. Kids have access to Head Start, to other services mm-hmm. that are there precisely to support mm-hmm. the folks that have low means in, yes. our society.
Right.
But if you don't have papers, you do not have access to any of those services.
Right, right.
And so it's above and beyond poverty. And so I always try to push folks a little bit to say it's beyond yeah. poverty.
Since this is your field of research in part and the effects of undocumented status on children in particular, just fill that out a little bit more. Say more about that kind of impact.
Well, there is definitely a strong emerging research that is demonstrating that, in fact, let me just begin by defining, we have what we call mixed status families. In fact, Norma mentioned that in her family, her parents came to the States with her and her sister, and so they both technically were undocumented. But the brother has papers, so yes. he's a citizen of the United States.
Right.
That's the kind of family we call mixed status families,
yes.
where we have multiple status.
Right.
Sometimes the parents are undocumented, one kid has DACA, the other one is a citizen kid, and the other one might have the right. You
right.
have all...
Lots of mixed pictures.
Exactly. So I just want to highlight that because it's very important to keep that when we're talking about immigration and the mm-hmm. impact that it has on the family.
Right.
With regards to precarious legal status, not having the papers, one of the things, at least the work that I do that looks at the impact of immigration status, particularly of the parent. So the parents are the protectors, the shields of the children, right? They're the ones that have the means as adults to access services, protections, all kinds of things on behalf of the children. If they're undocumented, they're blocked from doing that. That does not mean that the children who were born here, who are citizens, do not have the rights to have access to the services. But by association, because of fear of perhaps being targeted, the parents do not access some of those services. So that what we're seeing is that the parents' precarious legal status had an impact on the children. And yes, obviously, if we have children who were not born here and have liminal status, whether it's DACA status or came here and documented themselves, then they have sort of a double jeopardy on their side.
Right.
So it's very important to keep that in mind, because one of the things that we know is early on, to ensure the well-being of children, we want to give them as many opportunities as possible. But if we start restricting, and because of legal status, their access to opportunities, but also the access to be able to flourish, to explore, to risk, which is what is part of growing up, is limited and confined.
And fearful.
You know, the long-term effects are impactful, and impactful not just emotionally, psychologically, but also spiritually as well. And academically, you see it in all sorts of ways. It's a very huge problem that we have in our society at this moment in time.
So if we come back to your story then, Norma, in light of that kind of a set of circumstances, and DACA provides a way for you to get through your undergraduate days, then you decide that you're wanting to pursue further study and you end up exploring Fuller. And when you arrive here, I can only imagine I was not around then, but I can imagine that Fuller must have had earlier undocumented students perhaps, but certainly DACA was arriving on the scene or had only recently arrived on the scene by the time you start studying. Isn't that right? 2012 is when it's adopted. And when do you become a Fuller student?
2015.
So DACA had been in existence for 3 years. And therefore, we're on a very high learning curve as an institution, thinking this is a whole new reality. What do we understand? And I don't know at this stage where you are in your own sense of either expectations or your comfortability even in talking about it very much, even though it created the legal pathway for you to be able to be here. So tell us about that transition. You decide to come to Fuller because you've decided you want to pursue a PhD in psychology. Is that right?
And specifically it's called the integration piece of also within the Christian faith. And so Fuller felt like the place where God was calling me to. Mm-hmm. And I remember in that process in applying, I really prayed, God, are you sure this is what you want me to do? Because, I mean, you must know that I don't have the means and all of that. So
right.
I would pray and I would still feel like I needed to. And so I did everything. I called, I applied. I did ask, just because of the piece that I had heard about not being able to attend private schools, I called, I believe it was admissions, in order to see if I could apply, if that was going to be mm-hmm. a problem. And they didn't know what DACA was. They understood that I didn't have legal status. And they told me that was okay, but I wouldn't get financial aid. So same thing as before. And they also tried to, I guess in their way of helping, they tried to connect me with the international students mm-hmm. Representative,
right.
Which didn't go anywhere because uh-huh. I don't fall in that.
Right.
And so I just kept going with the process. I applied. I had made sure that I put in every document that I was a DACA recipient.
Yes.
And that was the case. And still, I exactly don't know. I mean, probably lack of knowledge, but nobody kind of picked up that this was going to be an issue.
What this really meant.
Yeah.
Well, right.
And at the time, the academic advisor for the School of Psychology, she tried to do her best. And once I knew what my advisor was, which is Dr. Rojas Flores, she's like, maybe you could talk to her and see if there's anything that she knows about. And out of all the people that I talked at Fuller in terms of trying to get help, she was the first person who knew what DACA was.
Yes.
And so then from there, I mean, she was like, here are 5 ideas, 10, whatever, that I have. I don't know if any of them is going to work, but let's do them.
So on your end, Dr. Rojas Flores, this is your first DACA student, is that right? So how were you processing what this would mean? For you, for Fuller, for the student, et cetera.
Well, I do remember she emailed me And for some reason, I didn't respond, did I?
No, you didn't.
No, I did not respond. All right. But you stopped me on the hallway. One day, I was rushing out, and she said, oh, I know you. May I speak with you for a minute? I said, yeah, a quick minute. But then again, I get stopped by students all along. And she said, oh, I emailed you. I think I'm going to be your advisee. So at that moment, I'm like, oh, okay, welcome. I'm so glad you're here.
Yes.
My apologies if they don't respond, so let's get in touch. She says, yeah, but I wanted to tell you I'm a DACA student, and I need help. And I thought, oh. That sort of stopped in my tracks because I realized, okay, what are we going to do? But then you did something else before that.
No, you know, in the email that I sent you,
You said it.
Yeah, I did. I wrote sort of, because I was also scared. I didn't know what to do. So I emailed her with the guise of, like, I'm introducing myself.
Right.
And so I, you know, shared who I was. And then I told her, look, this is my situation. These are all the things that I'm doing, like trying to fundraise, doing all of this stuff. But I don't know if you know of any other resources.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember when we talked and I said, do you have any money to come here? And you said, no, not really. Well, no, she said, you have some savings. So I asked her, what's the amount of savings you have? When she gave me the figure, I thought, okay, we're going to have to do some major work. But I remember being completely struck by your resourcefulness because you mentioned that, in fact, that money that you have saved up, how it came out, how you have had this art exhibit and you have worked with this advocacy agency to try to generate the money. And
tenacious,
you work really
hard, creative,
exactly,
committed,
the resilience, right. The resourcefulness. And I thought, wow, that's incredible. But I do remember telling you, have you considered all the schools? Because I don't know if you're going to be able to make this. And you were very adamant that you were called to be here. And I thought deep down, oh my God, you better deliver. I was seriously as impressed as I was afraid for you. Because I was thinking, okay, we have a problem. You do not qualify for financial aid. We have very little means, and you have a call to be here, and I don't know what we're going to do. That was a challenge from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
We have been in a challenge together.
Right, right. And that was all in your first year, is that right?
That was in the first week. We still had not even started. That was the summer.
Got it.
We're just getting oriented, as it were.
That was just getting to know each other. Yeah,
yes.
Good. So pick up the story from there, Norma.
I mean, from there, we just, I don't know if you recall, there was a letter that I wrote to you.
Mm-hmm.
There was, I don't know what else Dr. Lisseth did behind the scenes, who she talked to, but she was like, talk to this person, this person, this person. And I don't know what happened, but at some point I did get like an email. I think I got the email on a Wednesday, the week before orientation started. And on Friday, I came to Fuller.
Wow.
To Pasadena.
Amazing.
Saying that I could come
mm-hmm.
at least for a year.
Yeah.
And that was the thing. It was like, for 1 year, we could say yes. And then I said, okay. And then from there, it's like, who knows what's going to happen. And then the first day of school, I mean, it was all a culture shock.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that once I was in, that I was going to be the same as everyone else, that I was going to be at the same level, you know, and then coming in the first day with people and introductions, you know, sharing of even just legacy of their family, like they're theologians or they're psychologists or they've gone abroad and done these things or, you know, just this thing, like life experiences that I never had access to and that I don't have in terms of history. And so that was when it's this shock kind of, or this reality and this understanding that my life was so different from everyone else's that it started to become more prominent.
Yes.
And even when I did disclose my status from the get-go, It wasn't planned. It just kind of happened. And I think because of the history that I have in terms of knowing what DACA is and being the person to fill out paperwork and all of that, I knew how to describe it. I mm-hmm. knew what to tell people. And so for, you know, ever since being at Fuller, I've been teaching everyone about it.
Right.
And I think just that ability allowed me to speak about it in terms of with my friend, well, at that point, my peers and professors mm-hmm. who also just didn't know.
Right.
And so that just showed this gap, this mm-hmm. separation between the aspiration of, at least in my current case, clinical psychologists and the real world.
Right.
We were not even in the radar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And just imagine going into a place that doesn't know that you exist.
Right. Or that your category even exists.
Well, but that's the point.
Right.
Like, I don't exist
right.
to you.
Right.
So that has been a constant thing.
Very, very powerful. I know that you've said just now that it sort of put you in a position of being a teacher in a way that probably had a lot of sense of injustice about it, I would imagine, because of the feeling that that's not the way it should have gone. Can you say anything more about that? Because I think that's the experience of people that are DACA recipients. It's also experience of a lot of people of color, period, who are in circumstances where they end up feeling like they're teaching white people what white people don't otherwise know.
I mean, I had to. At this point today, right now, I specifically asked to not be the person to speak about what DACA was.
Right.
When I first came to Fuller, I had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
I had to.
Right.
If I wanted to stay here and if I wanted to continue and, you know, mm-hmm. fulfill this call that I felt God was, you know, calling me for, I had to.
Yes.
And so I did it. I did it without any reservation, whatever, you know, people wanted to ask, whatever. Mm-hmm. It was all there.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was getting connected to other people who heard about me and who said, you know, what can we do to help?
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I have always asked for is educate all people, mm-hmm. staff, administrators, all of that.
Right.
Because it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it even just changes dynamics. You know, for me, one of the things that now is sort of, it's a way that students will know if you're a safe person. And so coming in, the only even potentially safe person was Dr. Lizeth.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else, I didn't know how to approach.
Mm-hmm.
There's this big expectation from professors to students or administrators to students that it is the student that needs to initiate when they need help.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I had no avenue of exploring that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that piece, I still had to do it, even when I was scared, even when I was afraid, when I didn't know how it was going to be received.
Right.
I still had to do that.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. So, Dr. Rojas-Flores, when you're seeing this indirectly, sometimes directly, but sometimes indirectly for Norma, she's going through this experience, what do you remember about that first year or the first couple of years and how you were observing Norma negotiate this territory that really had been uncharted, wasn't even understood, full of all kinds of emptiness?
It was a difficult time, and it still is a difficult time. We're not going to candy coat the process. I think that first year was rough for both of us in different ways,
mm-hmm.
because I also did not know what to do. I think both of us were trying to figure it out together. She knew that she could come with my support, and at least I tried my best to convey it, sometimes a little hard, and sometimes more gently, that I was there trying to figure it out with her and to educate others about it mm-hmm. and to be strategic about how we were going to bring others mm-hmm. to understand her situation, but also to advocate
mm-hmm.
for DACA. But it was a hard year. I think the only place where we could talk about this, and I think all the students understood, was in my lab, because we were studying immigration enforcement mm-hmm. and the impact that it had on kids. But even so, it's still, we were not studying DACA per se.
Right.
We were studying the impact of immigration enforcement on families, misstatus families, not DACA per se. But it was the closest thing that mm-hmm, folks mm-hmm. were beginning to understand within our lab. And even then, it still took a little bit of time for other folks to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a completely uncharted territory for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
I was always struck by Norma's resilience mm-hmm. and also by her ability to take feedback, because mm-hmm. we will both make mistakes along the way. And sometimes as the advisor, I'll have to call it out. I say, okay, well, that was not good. Let's start again. And Norma had the ability to listen, mm-hmm. to also challenge me mm-hmm. many times sure. when I was the one that made the big mistake,
mm-hmm.
and to forgive me for that, you know, because I was learning. And she had the patience to at times say, okay, yeah, you blew it, and big time, to call me on it.
Right.
But to know that our relationship could stand that kind of back and forth. Mm-hmm. But it was a tough one. That year was hard. That mm-hmm. year was hard.
Well, and I think you pushed me to give you feedback.
Yes.
Again, I come from, like, this place of recognizing power dynamics and knowing, you know, that she's my advisor and that I depend a lot on you and your support, it was difficult for me to even think of, like, how I could challenge that.
Yes, yes.
And so she pushed me a lot to tell her what I was thinking, what I was feeling. She constantly, when there was anything about DACA or about me, she always pulled me in to get my feedback, kind of like consulting.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember just that piece and that process made me have to reflect and think and not just kind of go along with
mm-hmm.
what was being said. And I think something that has happened in that process is that she wasn't just seeing me as a student or as someone that just needed to finish a PhD, mm-hmm. but she was seeing me as a person. And that she was willing to relate to me in that way,
mm-hmm.
which has its own consequences about then me learning how to ask for help, how mm-hmm. to receive it, how to even receive care, mm-hmm. you know, on a way that I was not accustomed to and didn't believe that I could
right,
have.
Right.
And so I think what makes our relationship really work is that it's a full, holistic relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as opposed to just a formal relationship of some kind, yeah. So, Sonia, you're a pastor at Mountainside Communion, the name of the church that you serve. Where in Norma's story and her coming to Pasadena did the two of you then? Because in addition to an academic advisor and friend who was accompanying Norma, then you come into the story in some way. How did that unfold?
Yeah. I met Norma on a Palm Sunday morning in a joint worship service with La Fuente Ministries in Pasadena and Mountainside Communion. And I think we had joined for worship that morning to really have a multicultural space together. And I don't know how or who asked Norma to share part of her story. But our church has always had an emphasis on supporting, encouraging, assisting the immigrant communities around us. It's part of our history, and it came from listening to our neighborhoods for quite some time. And we also had a role in helping folks apply for DACA when it came out. Uh-huh. It was one of the first things we took action for as a church community with under the issue of mm-hmm. immigration.
Yeah.
But that morning, so Norma shared part of her story, and you know, it was great, and we're in this church space, and we're worshiping God, and it's lovely. You know, it's Palm Sunday, and I'm thinking to myself, this woman is courageous. She's brave. She's also, I could sense a reluctancy of, you know, kind of, she doesn't like the spotlight. She's not going to yell at anybody or try and rally. She just gently told her experience. And as a pastor, I get really squirmy about when in the church we have people share their story, and then if the if the purpose behind it, I don't know, if we all just leaving like feeling a little better that day, that's where I'm thinking. My radar just alerts me to the pretentiousness of having people share their stories. And I'm not saying that that's what it was, and that's not why she was invited, but it felt to me like there's so much here because you're a Fuller student, you're undocumented, and you're brave enough to stand up in front of people and share your story. And I'm a Fuller graduate, graduated in 2004, and I did some studies on mission and migration at that time. So for me personally, as a minister, I wanted to hear much more about this story. It wasn't going to be like a 5-minute, oh, that was nice, like clap your hands. It was going to be, Norma, thank you for sharing. Let's get coffee. And because I was feeling, I was wondering, my imagination was just being stretched. Like, what is it like for her to be a Fuller student? I wanted to know so much more. And we got coffee and got to know each other a little bit and then had a friendship.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in that coffee, you know, you were very explicit of wanting to join in and support me in whatever way you could. And again, now this is coming into also just other forms of power dynamics and recognizing who you were and stuff. And again, I just kind of had to kind of go slowly and sort of test it out. You know, what it meant. What was this about? And now what, it's been 3 or so years later, and I think she's one of my people.
Mm-hmm. That's really, really great. So give us a picture of the experience of being a student that has 1,000 different faces, and this could be a much longer conversation than we can have, but give us sort of some glimpses, especially as the narrative unfolds from those earliest days when it's just completely uncharted for you and uncharted for Fuller and uncharted for your mentor, and yet you're going on in this program. So give us some highs and lows along that process.
I mean, that's a big question. I don't know. Every year, almost every day, there was always something. One of the things that I've had the most difficulty with is planning. Dr. Lisseth would always tell me, make your schedule, make a plan, make this. And I would try, and something would come up, and that whole plan is gone. And so it just kind of got to the point where I just told her, look, I can't do this, these plannings. I will do my best to meet these deadlines, but I cannot sit down and plan, like, and pretend that I will be able to achieve this.
Yes.
And so that was always a constant thing. Mm-hmm. At first, I did have this greater instability in terms of financial resources. My first year, we spent trying to find funding and applying to these scholarships that I had less than a 1% chance of getting, and I never got them. But also in that, you know, I had to ask for support from Dr. Clements, who was a dean at that point, and also professors, and I asked Dr. Bjork, and just the fact that they said yes, you know, even though I had been there for like maybe 5 weeks, that was incredible for me. And because, like I've mentioned before, because I don't expect that kindness, I always remember who shows me kindness. Mm-hmm. And so there were just these little moments that said, okay, like, there's all of these other things that are unknown, but there's just these little glimmers of hope, of there are people that are willing to put, honestly, their hands in the fire for me in ways that I can't see or know. And so trusting in that process. And that's what it was like. And for my peers, it was about, I did have, in that case, that first year or 2 years, I was also gauging my space with them, what it meant for me to be there, to be with them. You know, the majority of my friends, they are white and come from certain backgrounds. There's very few people of color, even just in my cohort. So just trying to figure out what that meant, what things I could or couldn't say, you know, just trying to figure that out. Mm-hmm. And also finding other ways in terms of connecting, that there were still moments that we could relate to each other and identify pieces where it's like, oh, hey, like, I could be your friend and I could do this. And, you know, that didn't happen because I was a good person or because I was, or because I could see something that others couldn't see. It happened because I was forced to. Because if I don't make friends with them, who am I going to make friends with?
Right, right.
And so just that process has really struck with me and has stayed with me in terms of how important it is that we fill in these gaps mm-hmm. that our society has made. And there was a point by the end of my last year. So when I first came to Fuller, I was told by the academic advisor at the time that by the second year, the psychology students were burnt out. By the end of my first year, I was burnt out. And during the summer, it was horrible. For the first time in my life, I experienced panic attacks because I did not want to come back to Fuller. Mm-hmm. Just the weight of it all. But again, it was this mixture of little pieces, like people like Sonia, people like the Seth. Even by then, my cohort members who were now friends, like it was messy and painful. And I'm pretty sure it was awkward for them too and weird for them too and uncomfortable. But, you know, we've been trying to do something together. And I think that is part of what has been sustaining for mm-hmm. me, because people always ask, like, how do you do it? And I don't think I have a clear answer other than God wants me here. And so whatever he does, it sustains. It reminds me of, what was it? I think it was Isaiah, where he goes and to the woman and her son, and they only have like a little bit of bread and a little bit of oil, and they feed him, and somehow there's more. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, somehow there's more that I can do and give in this process that I can't explain.
Mm-hmm. You know, but I just want to say something, but I think that you have been a catalyst for us to be pushed, challenged to address these issues at Fuller, within my lab, within class, just because you came and say, this is who I am. You're the courageous one that put your skin on the line for us to be able to respond. Mm-hmm. And that's very powerful. And you're right, it takes a community to walk through this together, and it's messy, it's invigorating, it's challenging, it's annoying, it's frustrating, it's anxiety-provoking, but it's a wonderful path of growth for you, you know, from what I hear you, but also for me has been amazing. And I think for the Fuller community as a whole, we're growing because you were brave, you responded to a call.
Amen. Yeah, that's very true. I think that Fuller is definitely the recipient through you and through some other DACA students that there are gifts to be received that we desperately need, can't receive any other way, need to receive in order to be changed ourselves as an institution, personally and otherwise. And it's like anything that suddenly introduces you to the dominating reality that you live with is not the dominating reality of other people at Fuller. And that, just that juxtaposition makes it super intense for you in a way that I don't think anybody else can possibly measure, because it's just so extraordinary to imagine. And that is every bit as real a world as the world that other people are living. And we can't live ignorantly of that juxtaposition, these two things. And it's not even just meant to be side by side. It's actually in some way meant to be co-held. And I think what I'm hearing and what's meaningful to me about this conversation with all three of you is the fact that you do represent people, among others, who have been critical in that co-forming, co-laboring long process. And I was just really struck a week ago when we had the chance to pray for you at chapel, how much poorer we would be as a community if we didn't have the opportunity to do that, and how much this calls us, as so many other things can, if we're willing to be open to it, beyond the bounds of our normal sociology and our own circumstances and backgrounds. So I want to say thank you, Norma, for taking this risk and for letting us in some way try to walk alongside you in that. I know, both Sonia and Lisette have been key in that. There's been others absolutely in the Fuller community that I think have been part of that too. And I'm just really very grateful. I want to do a little fast forward. We all know the kind of national debate that's been going on around immigration, which is the big backdrop to this. Then we know the 2016 elections. Then we know the instability of DACA. Then we know that it's on, it's off, it's on, it's off. Oops, no, now it's going to be declared to be being brought to an end. Then a case that ultimately comes to the Supreme Court is mounted, and that has been the focus of this week, when really I would say millions of people around the country have been riveted by this drama, because it's a very different drama than just kind of, I don't know, generic immigration legislation, let's call it, or something. This is really like, wow, we're talking about a large but still pretty finite group of people who are walking on the knife edge of a drama that will dramatically affect your lives and also therefore affect our lives. So we prayed for you. We sent you and your team, as it were, off to Washington, D.C. Tell us a little bit about what the experience was before the time that you got to D.C. with perhaps other people that were also student plaintiffs. As I understand, there were 10, is that the right number? 11 plaintiffs within the DACA who are DACA recipients and whose DACA status is jeopardized by the declaration that the president has made. So how did you get to the point of being made a plaintiff? How did that even happen? And then tell us a little bit about the experience this week in D.C.
So public counsel reached out and they told me about the lawsuit. And at that point, I mean, for me, there was really no question about it. All I needed to do was just check to make sure that my family would not somehow be hurt by my decision.
Right. Yeah.
And even that, both my parents said, you know, don't worry about us. Do what you have to do. And so I said yes. And it's funny because there were different people who actually that I consulted with, and they were like, don't do it. Because I guess they could foresee a little bit better than I could how difficult that was going to be. But I just, in terms of trying to think of like how this could affect my life, it's hard to think how it could affect my life. And so, you know, on the other hand, how could it affect my life if I don't? So it was just very clear. And additionally, just with the sense that coming to Fuller wasn't just to get a degree, and that it was something bigger than that. And I never thought it was going to be a lawsuit, you know, but there it was. And so I said yes. And then from then on, it's just, I don't know. I mean, it's been intense. I think I'm as tired as I've ever been. I do know, even just as I keep learning more about just these different aspects about stress and toxic stress and trauma and all of this, and it's like, I'm in it. I am experiencing these
right.
things.
Name it. Mm-hmm.
And still, Sadly. I have to find a way to, Sadly. You know, do research, do therapy, be a student, all of those things. And then the lawsuit. And so there's been a lot of really difficult times. And at the same time, I also just feel that that's why I'm in it. Mm-hmm. Because whenever I now get a chance to speak that people want to hear about my story, about what I have to say, I bring this into the conversation. Mm-hmm. And that it's not just that we have an economic contribution to this country, mm-hmm. but it is that we are just so, as people, we are so knit into our communities mm-hmm. that
absolutely.
Maybe, you know, there might be a sense that, let's say, you know, to put Fuller as an example, that if I had never been here and maybe other students hadn't been here, that whatever happened to us wouldn't be directly felt, mm-hmm. but it would be so indirectly affected in terms of what values and perspectives we build.
Absolutely.
And so this last quarter, when I was coming back from Vegas, because I try to visit whenever I can, during the summer coming back, I started to get really, really anxious. I don't think I had a panic attack because I was driving. So it was like, you know, hold it together. Mm-hmm. But I was very, very anxious because I knew what was coming. I knew that I needed to propose. I needed to do, you know, internship applications. I needed to do just all of these things.
All the things that are part of your program. And this.
Right. And specifically the court.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's been hard. But then at first I had actually just invited Dr. Lizeth and Sonia to come with me to the Supreme Court because unlike the one for the Ninth Circuit, which was here in Pasadena, mm-hmm. going to D.C. was just a lot to ask for, I think, absolutely. In my opinion. And so I did not feel comfortable, you know, making that. But in that process, I don't know how it happened that then other people kind of...
We're like, who else do you want to come?
But then also other people kind of invited themselves and it was great. Like, it was a good thing. And this sort of asked what's happened. So I even asked for two of my best friends also to kind of become part of this group, one from Vegas and one from Mexico. And looking back at this week, I don't think any other plaintiff had this amount of support. They had maybe a family member, and that was maybe like two other plaintiffs, I think.
Mark called it a delegation in the introduction. I would rather call it a wolf pack because Norma's favorite animal is a wolf, and we were a pack. We were... Mm-hmm.
Right. We were there. Right.
Yeah. And so seeing how it was done, I feel like I could have done it on my own, but I'm just so thankful that all of you were there. It brings something different.
Absolutely.
The first time that I really felt the impact of having there was when we were at this big reception with like 300 people, all who were either plaintiffs or have been working in this activism. Mm-hmm. And we were asked to say, you know, who are you fighting for? Mm-hmm. And they happened to all kind of be in a line close to each other. And to hear them say that they were fighting for me was incredible. And it's just, I don't know, I don't think I have words to really put that into what that felt like. And so then that was there. And then there was another moment, which I'm sure... most people saw the beginning of that moment when we came out of the Supreme Court.
Yes.
What isn't seen, because then it just kind of got crazy, is that I had people to come sort of home to as I was walking down. I wasn't alone. And I remember seeing Lizeth. I think you were the first person that I saw. And I hugged you and you were beaming. You were just beaming. And I don't know how to explain that. Everybody was beaming who I saw. I don't remember the order. But it was just this sense of, like, I guess that, coming home, mm-hmm. hugging people who I knew who were there for me. Mm-hmm. And then I was off to, like, media stuff.
Interviews. I have the greatest picture of you smiling.
Well, and Norma, you have given words to that. If you could just mention what you've told me before about the difference between allies and friends.
Well,
that's
been
meaningful for me to hear you say.
In terms of in this process, you know, when people ask me what I need, when I don't really know what that is, I always ask not for people to be an ally, but to be my friend. Because when you're, you know, it's a mutual thing. If you're my friend, I will do what I believe a good friend to be. And if you're that to me, we're doing that to each other. Mm-hmm. And it's no longer a sense of like, oh, well, you need me to be an ally, so I'm going to be here for you. Call me if you need me. But if, you know, something is going on with your life or whatever, like, I can't tell you that because your life is worse than mine. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to burden you. Like, it's just a very different feeling to that. And then the other piece that really stuck out to me while I was there was after that big crazy day where I didn't eat until like 4 or something, coming home to the place we were at and just playing a game, playing Telestrations, and having just a very normal yet very significant moment of mm-hmm. being together and laughing.
We laughed so hard.
That I don't, again, I keep wondering and I keep thinking about other people, other DACA recipients, other people in the undocumented community who were so worried that day and who are avoiding even reading any news about DACA or that day because they don't have that structure, that community mm-hmm. that is there for them. And I was able to laugh and connect. Mm-hmm. And I want that to be replicated. I want that for all of us.
And Norma, one of the things that struck me in all this, and under the pressure that she was, she wanted to make sure that we conveyed a message to all the DACA recipients about how to take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And one of the images that was just so inspiring to me was we were trying to record this little clip. So I'm like, okay, when you're stressed, you know, soaking the beauty of the world, blah, blah, blah. You were trying. And so we have the camera crew was all of us.
With our little cell phones.
Right. Right. And at one moment, the sun was coming down. And it was getting dark. And so it's like, whoa, we need light. And all the cell phones. And so we have this camera crew with their cell phones
lights.
It was putting together a gift for other DACA recipients with stones and sticks. And it was just hilarious.
Yes,
I mean, the craziness of it, but the power. I was taking it in, being part of it with Norma and with everybody. And at the same time, so humble by the fact that we knew we had so much power and so much to give with the meager little cell phones and lights that we were trying to record a big message.
Yeah.
But that came because Norma was thinking
of others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And reminded us that we needed to help others and to share that experience of being together and bearing the burden together.
I think that's a perfect place to end. I think that obviously none of us knows sitting here today exactly what the Supreme Court's going to do. There's still acute vulnerability and a lack of knowledge. There were signs that some interpret as an indication that DACA may not be sustained. There's other people who are trying to argue the opposite of that. But in actual fact, we have to wait still further to find out what it is that's really happening. And so I'm aware that we're still in a very vulnerable place. And to me, this conversation has just been an enormous gift, and I think it will be to the people that hear it. And I want to say thank you to all of you, but I do particularly want to say thank you to you, Norma.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.